Welcome to the show. Greg Kokel here, your host. The show is called Stand to Reason. Glad you're a part of it here today. Just a reminder, by the way, this is the show that I think goes out on, is it Thursday or Friday? So maybe it's too late for this announcement. But this weekend coming up, I'm speaking on Tuesday, 3 days. Of course, we have our reality in Seattle. And at last count, there are 90 seats that were still left. We hope those are all gobbled up in the next few days. But I encourage you to check it out if you'd like to come Friday night and all day Saturday. You've got a great roster of speakers, J. Warner Wallace, Alisa Childers. Christopher Yuen. I'm just thinking because we got so many that come to these things, which are the ones on the roster right now. Alan Schliemann, of course, and I'll be there. And so we have a great lineup for passing the baton to the younger generation. That's the goal of our reality conferences. It's going to be October 16th and 17th. That's this weekend coming up. And you can get all the information about it at realityapologetics.com. Incidentally, and one other thing, by way of announcement, just to keep you kind of up on this, the fact that we're locked down now doesn't mean that our team cannot serve you as speakers at your events. In fact, on Monday, just yesterday, I actually did three different talks from my church speaking to an empty audience. My church graciously let me use the venue and their cameraman and their cameras and everything. And I did a whole presentation. Actually, I did three of them for different conferences, which then get packaged up and sent to my hosts so they can then play them in their video events that continue to go on. So this is the kind of thing we can do. And we do radio interviews and we do, and this is all of us, whether it's John or Alan or Tim or myself, we are all available for these kinds of things. And if you want to see if we can work something out with you for this kind of thing, or maybe a YouTube interview or video blog or whatever, just contact Darcy, D-A-R-C-Y, at str.org. That's Darcy at str.org. Now, I've got quite a few people on board here, and I want to get to them very quickly. I had some longer comments that I was going to offer, but I'm just going to make an observation instead of my longer comments about something that I was reading in Scripture. Okay. I was reading here and there, and two passages linked up on my point. So a couple of days ago, I was reading Exodus 4 and 5, or 3 and 4, and that's the burning in the bush, God's speaking to Moses about go, let my people go kind of thing. And then I was reading in Hebrews 12 today, and there was a reference that was also made to this broader circumstance. And that relates to the issue of hearing God's voice. And an argument that often is put forward for the practice people have of intuiting a communication to them from God is that, look, at whatever's available to us or was available to believers in olden times ought to be available to believers now. Now, I think that point itself is contentious. I think that can be argued that that's not actually the case, that in the past this was these people that God communicated directly with was unique. But there's another observation I want to make just quickly, and that is, if the claim is that the same kinds of things that happened in the past can happen to us now, then they ought to be the same kinds of things. Simple as that. And so when I look at what people are saying that they're hearing from God and the modality, so to speak, of how this takes place, it turns out it's not at all like what happened in the Scriptures, okay? And I have a lot I could explain on this from the book of Acts, for example, but I just want to make an observation very quickly about the reading that he did in Exodus and also in Hebrews. And what it says there in Exodus, and you can go back and read yourself, Moses is out tending the sheep and he sees a bush that is on fire, but it is not being consumed. And this piques his curiosity, no duh, and he walks over there, and the text says that he hears a voice from the middle of the bush. That, and it, actually it says this a couple of times. The voice was coming out of the bush. The voice wasn't somehow bouncing around in his head. He wasn't having an impression that he was thinking might be from God. The voice was coming from a physical location over there from inside of the fire that was burning but not consuming. In other words, the voice was third person public. And not only was it that modality in that particular case, the phenomenology, we might say, as philosophers, but when I was reading in Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 12, there was a reference to Moses and the people, a different time now. They've already left Egypt, now they're at the mountain. But what's going on? Another conversation with God. And how are the people responding to the conversation that Moses is having with God? It scares them. There's a short reference there in Hebrews, but if you go back to the original text where this happened, you got more detail. They said, "Go away, Moses, go over there. We hear God's voice talking to you, and it scares us. We don't want to get scared. Go away." Which is another indication that when God and Moses conversed, it was a verbal conversation, so verbal that it had a physical location it was coming from, and it was the kind of thing that other people who were present could have heard if they were there. But that is not the kind of thing, characteristically, that people are talking about when they say, "God told me thus and so." No, it's always something internal, almost without exception. It's just an awareness. It's in their head or whatever. So if the argument is going to be, which itself I think is contestable, that what happened to people in the Old Testament, we have equal access as New Testament folk, then it should follow then the things that happened, the very particular kinds of things that happened in the Old Testament should be the things that happen in our experience if that rule applies. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Like I said, I have a lot more that I could say about that particular point, but I have lots of callers here. Just wanted to drop that on you and have you think about it. And by the way, look up the passages yourself. Go to Exodus chapter 3 and 4 and see for yourself. Go to Hebrews chapter 12. Towards the end of the chapter, there's a reference here. Check out the cross-reference and go back to Exodus where that event being referred to in Hebrews 12 is actually taking place and see if that's not the case. Check it out for yourself. Okay, enough on that. Let's go to, I'm a little confused here about the order. I see Thomas hold button flashing, so I'm just going to presume that's the one that Amy wants me to go to. Amy, can you show your picture here and just nod if that's who you want me to go to, line 3? Yes, okay, thank you. Okay, now go away, Amy. And I will go on the air to Tom in Schenectady, New York. That's a hard one to say. Welcome to the show, Tom. Whoops, I hit that button again. Okay, there you go. You're on now. Sorry.
Oh, hey, Greg. Thanks for your ministry.
You're so welcome.
I'm a strategic partner, and I encourage all of the listeners today to consider becoming one if you're not one. This ministry
My special thanks to you, Tom. I really appreciate all of our strategic partners. Glad to take your call today.
Well, I've got two questions. Amy said you might be able to answer both. I know you got a lot of callers.
Yeah.
The first one is worship. I've been a Christian for a while. I'm 57 years old now, and I'm realizing that I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing during worship.
Mm-hmm.
One of the issues I have is I don't really like the music. It's sort mm-hmm. of contemporary. I like mm-hmm. traditional hymns,
mm-hmm.
which is okay. But if I'm not raising my hands and swaying back and forth like my fellow Christians that I'm worshiping with,
yeah.
Does that mean I'm not worshiping? And secondly, should I be doing that? I feel kind of awkward doing it, and it takes it takes my mind off of God, and it puts it on me.
Right, right. Well, the simple answer to the second question is no, it is not the case that you should be doing that. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't be doing that, but I think that how a person's posture is during worship should be an expression of that person's desires in that moment. So there are times when I will raise my hands in prayer. Now, I mean worship, rather. I know your other question has to do with prayer, but my or an element here is about prayer. But when I was in a tradition out of the Jesus movement where there was an expressive element of worship and people raised their hands and you know, swayed back and forth, whatever. But so there is a natural maybe habit or whatever, or it has become natural for me to express my worship before God by raising my hands. But when I do that, I am aware that there is a connection between what I'm doing physically with my body and what I'm attempting to be doing before the Lord. That is, I'm raising my hands because I feel a sense of closeness or respect or something, that this raising of the hand is an expression of my love for God and my honoring of Him. By the way, worship is simply probably most easily understood as ascribing worth to God. We are worshiping, that is, we are giving or affirming the worth of God Himself. How great thou art, you know, like that song. It's more of a classic hymn. And when I consider all the things that you have made, you know, then my soul responds, you know, how great thou art, how great thou art. That's what worship is. It's ascribing something to God. Now, I think worship also naturally entails the emotions, but not necessarily. And the reason I say not necessarily is that there are times that we are not going to feel emotionally caught up in our worship, but God no less deserves the worship we give Him. So we don't worship God principally as a result of our feelings of something happening with us, but we worship Him principally because of who He is and what He's done. And when you look in the Psalms, you see both of that, those things: who He is, your excellent greatness, and what He's done, your excellent works. You know, I think Psalm 51 covers both of those things. I'm not, or 50, 150 is what I meant. And so the last Psalm. So when I go to worship, what I want to do is I want to ascribe worth to God. Now, I'm not at all surprised, Tom, that you are frustrated with contemporary worship, because I am too. And the thing that frustrates me is much of contemporary worship is about the worshiper. It is not about God. It is not Christocentric. It's not theocentric. It's anthropocentric. So we are talking about our feelings. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we love our wives, and so we express our feelings to our wives, and that's appropriate. And if we love God and that part of that has an emotional, affective element, then we're expressing that to God. And I think that is part of what worship entails. You are great, and I love you for your greatness. Fine. But I think what's happened is that the balance is way off on the other side. And so I remember once speaking at a chapel in a university whose name I will not mention, because I don't want to disparage them. But I was getting ready to speak, and the worship set was going, and I was thinking to myself and looking up at the wall of the words, and I thought, these people are singing to themselves. They're not singing to God. And I wouldn't be surprised if part of your frustration is because of that. And I remember going to a conference once in Seattle, a group of really good people, but the worship was like that too. And I was not feeling very good about my life at the time. And so I noticed that when we were singing these songs about ourselves, I'm thinking, I can't sing that song. Because that, it, as an expression, the words as an expression of my emotional state, this is not honest. There's no integrity in me singing this. And I think that a lot of these songs are written that talk about our emotions, not because they reflect our emotions, but to cause the emotions to happen. Okay? That bothered me. And I also noticed that when there was a shift in the music from being anthropocentric to theocentric, focusing on God and his qualities, that my feelings actually began to change. First, I felt I could sing them with integrity. Oh, good. I'm not singing. I don't want to sing about myself. I want to sing about God. And as I'm singing about God, then my emotions did begin to change, though not always. I can still ascribe worth to God honestly and with integrity if the statements I'm making in my music are true.
Yeah, even
not
if you don't
whether
feel,
I have a good feeling about it. Sorry, go ahead.
So even if you don't feel, I don't know, joyful in that moment, you can still worship God.
I absolutely. And in fact, if that weren't the case, there would be a whole lot less worship going on in my life. Because when I go to church, I'm not always feeling good. Yeah. You know, I'm not being a crybaby, I'm just saying. And so what I want to do is I want to get away from myself and my feelings, and I want to focus on God. And by the way, this is another reason that I don't like when worship leaders get clever. All right? If you're going to lead a song, don't do anything tricky. What's the right word here? Like adding a bunch of trills or whatever, you know, people who are performers do. Whoa, 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 you know, whatever like that. Just do the song, because the minute somebody does that, I'm paying attention to the worship leader. I am not in worship anymore. They're drawing all kinds of attention to themselves. Let the worship songs be sung in an ordinary way so that everyone can follow it, and then the worship leader can get out of view, so to speak. I've actually wished sometimes that the worship leaders would get in the back of the church, not in the front.
Yeah.
So that they can lead us in worship instead of being tempted to be clever entertainers in some sense. Make sense?
But, yeah, it sure does. But then, you know, I don't want to be critical because, you know, the unity of the body and all that.
Well, I don't take your questions as critical. I take them
right.
as a struggle to be more appropriate in the way you live your Christian life, say, in worship. And I do think there are many distractors in a worship service that are not appropriate. One reason I like the older stuff rather than the new stuff, and there's some exceptions to this, but the old stuff is more theocentric.
Yeah.
And have pretty melodies, you know, and everybody can follow along.
I've incorporated hymns to the end of my daily time with God, which is helping me. And
oh,
I find that I'm worshiping that way. I'm looking at the words, the beautiful words, like just as I am, for example.
They're excellent. So there's a very common hymn. There's one as I'm driving in today and on an errand by myself. I'm thinking, there's a song, Jesus, Jesus, how I love you, how I need you more and more, something to that effect. La da 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 da, how I need you more and more. I can't actually remember all of the words to this whole hymn, but I remember that refrain and the sound of it. And I put my own words in it. Jesus, Jesus, how I love you. I want to love you. Oh, for grace to love you more. Oh, for grace to trust you more. So I take the hymn and I put some of my own variations in it to be able to pray the song from my heart.
Yeah.
And that's what I think worship ought to be. Ideally, is to be able to sing these words not from your will, which I as I pointed out, I think is totally adequate, but an honorable. But also from your heart, meaning your emotions, from yourself, and it's expressive that way, because I think it's more satisfying, and it's easier to do that if you don't have some worship leader being clever and distracting you. So you had more though to your question.
Yeah, I do. This one's painful.
But before you get to the second one, there is a variation here. It says, "How is it different from prayer?"
Well, yeah, because I. just quickly, how would you differentiate prayer and from worship?
Well, worship is an ascribing worth to God, and expressing one's love for God. Okay, that would be part of that. All right, that's the emotive element for us, and prayer is also a place where you might be expressing your love for God. And so in prayer, generally, something else is going on because prayer is petition characteristically, although prayer could also include praise. But prayer usually is petition. Make your requests known to God, it says in Philippians, all right? And what I described just a few moments ago as I'm singing this simple song, this hymn, is I'm actually making the hymn a prayer. And for me, it was very satisfying. Oh, for grace to love you more. Lord, I need to love you more. Oh, for grace to trust you more. So I am using a worship song to express a petition. And for me, when I do that, that's pretty cool. I mean, I really like that. That is satisfying to my soul. So I consider the two distinct, but they can be joined together. Simple way of answering.
Can't wait for tomorrow morning.
You don't have to wait till tomorrow morning.
Yeah, true.
You can hang up and then go to it if you want. All right.
Second one's kind of painful. I'm kind of made a mess of things somehow. I'm married. I have a daughter and a son. And I mean, we raised our kids in a church. You know, my daughter used to sing in the choir for crying out loud. And she went away to school, and a couple of years ago, she told me she's gay. She has a same-sex partner. And she asked me if I would walk her down the aisle someday. And I told her, no, I can't do that. I could if you marry someone of the opposite gender. And she didn't understand it, and I showed her scripture.
But she didn't understand that you have this conviction that, I mean, having been raised in your family with you and with your background, she honestly didn't understand how you could have a moral conviction that would dictate your behavior under this circumstance, wedding in particular.
No, she really doesn't, because she's immersed in this sewer culture of New York City.
Right.
It's normal there. That is the norm there.
Right.
To call marriage between a man and a woman down there is abnormal.
Yeah, right. I just read an article about that, by the way, just today, or at least a segment, a review of a book. And it was basically that heteronormativism is dangerous. Heterosexuality is dangerous. This is what I couldn't believe it. Anyway, that's another issue.
Well,
so go ahead.
And I'm one of those $1 apologists, so I'm third column kind of person. And my son is basically an agnostic. I don't know. We've spoken a few times, but I believe that because I told my daughter that I wouldn't go to her wedding, that he has become very hostile to Christianity because he sees this as a beautiful thing, and daughter's, you know, his sister's happy and found someone. And
the moment, maybe.
So I don't know if it's, you know, I have a guilt thing. You know, I see other people at church with intact families, and I see mine. And I love my kids. And
of course you do. So let me offer some thoughts. And I'm certainly not an expert on this kind of thing, but I will tell you quite candidly, and this is not especially a secret, but my eldest daughter, who I baptized, is not a confessing Christian right now. And she has views about issues, I'm not going to get into details, that are very, very different from my views. And when this became evident, it was such a explosive thing for me that I did not handle it well. And now a couple of years later, she's only 15 right now, but a couple of years later, we have a much better relationship. And in fact, I'm having a daddy date with her tonight, which is very unusual for her because she doesn't like to leave the house.
That's awesome.
And so wow, that's great. And as soon as, like, in 35 minutes, we're heading out, you know, after the show. So, but what I have discovered is it is less important right now. This may be controversial, but I'm just going to say this and you can judge for yourself. It is less important for me right now to persuade her of my views than it is for me to persuade her of my love.
Ugh.
Okay? If there is an environment where a person does not feel loved and accepted as themselves, now, I am not saying here that you need to accept in the sense of approve of the behaviors, because I don't hold the view that loving a person means approving of their behaviors, because they don't have that view towards us.
Right.
That is, those people with that view don't have that same attitude towards those who don't hold the view. You know, you must accept me just the way I am. Well, then why don't you accept me just the way I am with my views contrary to yours if you say you love me? Okay. What I am saying is that there has to be a palpable expression of actual paternal love for your children who don't hold your views. And that means expressing that in all kinds of different ways. This was difficult for me, but over the last few years, I have really worked hard at it, okay? And it's been paying dividends. Now, has my daughter attempted to change her views because of that? No. As far as I could tell, I have no reason to think that that's going to happen. But I think not only is loving my daughter an appropriate end in itself, but changes are never going to happen, I think, in her thinking about other things unless that's at least in place. And if that's in place and my daughter goes her own way on a whole bunch of other issues, I have still done my job as a dad, because it is not my job to win her to Christ. It is God's job to win her to Christ. It is not my job to make sure she agrees with me on everything. She's a human being. She's an individual. And kids go their own way, just like you and I did,
yep.
Right? And everybody else. And that's just the way human beings are. They grow up and they adopt their own views. And we do our best when we can, but we don't control people. We can't do that. But we can love people. And so my focus has been on the love side of things. Now, this does create a problem, though, because you're accused of being unloving because you won't walk her down the aisle.
Right.
And this is where I think it's appropriate for you to say no, because you have a strong conviction about this thing that does not allow you to, with integrity, do this thing.
Right.
You can be friendly to your daughter's companion. You can have them over for dinner. You can show them all kinds of affection and love and acceptance as a couple. But what you can't do is participate in a way that you are complicit in something that you think is wrong. And by the way, she wouldn't do it for you. Ask her. You know, I'm going to a meeting tomorrow night where somebody's giving a talk against homosexuality. Honey, will you come with me?
No.
I would love to have you with me. Not that, you know, you have to change your own mind about it, but it would just be nice to do this thing together. Oh, she would never do that.
No.
Because her conviction doesn't allow her to do it. So that might be a point that you could make with her or your son graciously. We all have lines that we draw in the sand that are tied to our personal integrity. And others should respect that. Out of love. So if your daughter didn't want to come with you to that event, you know, if you made a big fuss about it and called her names or whatever, you're unloving. Well, that wouldn't be appropriate for you to do that, because she's drawn a line in the sand based on her values and her personal sense of integrity, and that's something you should respect. Okay, honey, I get it. But you don't withhold love.
No.
For that, because love is a unilateral obligation that a father has for his daughter and his son.
But I want to please God with how
right.
I raised her, and I don't know.
Well, are you judging whether or not you please God and how you raised her by what she now believes?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a mistake.
Okay.
From me to you, Tom, you can't control what she ends up doing with her life. There may be things you could have done better. Guess what? That's true with every single parent. And I will struggle being autobiographical here, too. As I look in the past, I see all kinds of mistakes that I made. I wish I could undo them. I wish I could do them differently. I wish I would have started earlier with my children, though the daughter I'm speaking of now was baptized when she was 6 years old. But still, you know, so there's always going to be things we think we could have done better, and we would probably be right by that. But ultimately, we can't control those things. So I am giving my time now principally to prayer,
yep,
and love and grace and tenderness and affection and all of those kinds of things. And when I have opportunity, I might communicate something that is appropriate for the circumstances about my own values. And she can, I mean, she's, you know, a semi-adult now, so she's going to have to make her own decisions about that. So that's what I would say, Tom. I think you're in a tough spot. But you're in a similar spot to a whole bunch of parents who see their children going in a different direction than what is good for them and what they raised them in. And that is painful to the soul. But nevertheless,
what do you say if they ask you about hell?
Pardon me?
What do you say to them if they ever ask you about hell?
I tell them the truth. I said, we have a choice. Either Jesus pays for our sin, or we pay.
But she doesn't think homosexual behavior is sin.
Well, in that kind of circumstance, I wouldn't make homosexuality the issue, because even if she wasn't gay or lesbian, she would still be a dirty, rotten sinner just like you.
Correct.
And me. So in a certain sense, that detail is inconsequential. When it comes to the issue of the gospel proper, that detail is inconsequential.
So back off the gas pedal there.
Yeah, yeah. Let's okay. Forget about that. I guarantee you, she is aware of all kinds of things that are wrong in her life just because she's a human being who knows she's morally broken, even if she pushes back and acts like, no, she's just fine, because that's the human condition. All right, Tom?
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I would. I actually wouldn't mind hearing an update someday.
If
you want to call back and just chat a little bit. So, okay.
Thanks.
God keep you, brother.
God bless.
All right, thank you. Bye. Wow. All right. I mean, some moments are just absolutely rich. We're going to forego the rest of our commercials because we've got three people on board here, and I've got the flashing button, so that means Amy is trying to tell me to talk with Kino in Abbotsford, British Columbia. That would be Canada. Kino, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg.
Hey.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're so welcome.
I have to tell you, I was super excited to hear that you were having a reality conference in Bellevue. Because I'm just right by the border in the northwest of Canada.
Oh, really? Okay.
So yeah.
But will they let you cross the border?
No, unfortunately not.
Oh, see, that's it.
I won't be able to make it across.
This is why Tim Barnett, you know, is stuck up in Toronto. We're going to have him there on video for some special things. We're going to play some Red Pen Logic episodes for the crowd. But no, he can't cross the border. So I'm sorry, you're not able to make it. Maybe next year.
Yeah, hopefully. So my question, I was listening to an STR Ask podcast that you guys did back in August 17th, I believe, and you guys were you had a question or ask a question defining free will and choices if they were different, but that's not necessarily where my question comes from. It's more when you and Amy were in your discussion, I started to develop a little bit of confusion with how I was kind of understanding what a human choice kind of looks like, in the sense that I'm struggling with where the responsibility of a person's choice fits into that picture.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, you would say something like, oh, well, I chose, you give an example of choosing to eat a specific thing for breakfast in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of you ate that because you wanted it, or maybe we could equate the want with a desire.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of would you say our wants and desires, we could equate those two words?
Well, I think those wants and desires, they sound like most of the time when people are using those words, are using them synonymously. But there's a difference between wants, desires, and choices. Wants, desires may suggest – I'm trying to find the right word here. Wants and desires may like suggest choices. So it's like, oh, I want and had desire this thing. So there are choices I could make to satisfy that desire. However, I have to ask the question whether the thing that I desire is a right thing to choose. And it may be the case that your desire is not always under your control. Now, I think there is some role the will can play in our desires as we manage them. So there are ways that let's say a desire is like a little fire. We can either feed that fire or not. And if we feed the fire, that desire can grow stronger and stronger and stronger, and then, in a certain sense, overcome our will. And then we do the thing according to the desire that's not right to do, and then we've sinned. We make a choice that's not right. Now, we can also make a choice when the desire comes up not to feed the desire, so if it's a bad desire, it gets so overwhelming that we give in to it. So I think you can control your desires to some degree. But the thing that matters is the choice that we make about the desire in question. That's mm-hmm. the thing that matters, and that's the thing we're responsible for. And nowadays, I'll just finish the thought real quickly you, Kino. Nowadays, the idea is, and this is, I don't think you're saying this, but this is the way the culture is, if I feel it and I want it, I ought to be able to choose it. And if you don't let me choose what I feel I want, then you're mean and cruel and God is bad. That's the way people look at it. But that's a childish way of looking at this thing. Adults that I think have properly informed consciences realize that their choices cannot just simply fit whatever desire they have, but their choices have to be governed by sound morality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think I'm following there, but I guess I'm still a little bit unsure of what to think of, because
okay.
When I think about a desire, there's right desires and wrong desires, and we can choose to feed the right desires and not feed the wrong desires. Yeah. But it also seems like let's say a person has a value system. And
if a person has what? Say that again.
Let's just say that a person has a value system of
a value system, right.
So more value system, something like that. And they have a desire that they start experiencing, and they know it's a wrong desire, and they have mm-hmm. they also have a value that they shouldn't feed those desires. So it almost seems like that value system kind of creates another desire within them to not feed that first desire.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and that you might be talking about this as kind of second order desires. So one has a desire. I mean, we're guys, so you know, guys are distracted by other women. It's just the way we're made, and so this stirs up a desire. But we also have a desire to do what's right regarding this first desire, and so therefore then we act in such a way as not to inflame that lustful desire. But what if a person has a lustful desire they know is wrong, but doesn't have any desire to constrain that? Well, that is a value judgment. That is a value issue, and the value at that point is that they do not value something that's good, that is self-restraint regarding that desire. And because they don't value the good thing, then they are willing to choose the bad thing, even though they know it's a bad thing. So they're still responsible.
Yeah.
Now you might say, well, they don't value that. That's not their fault. Well, it is. I'm just, I mean, it is their fault. And in fact, we hold people responsible for that. People who don't value other people's human life and kill them with impunity, well, they have a value problem. But they still, we still hold them responsible, even though their values are different than ours. Yeah, their values are different, and their values are bad. They are wicked. They are immoral. Even if this is just what naturally comes from them, it doesn't change the wickedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it kind of seems like, yes, we hold them accountable for those things, and they ought to have a value that aligns with what is right and wrong. But then it still seems, I guess I'm kind of thinking in terms of like cause and effect. Examples here where it seems like we can have a desire and our value systems can influence how we choose with those desires.
Yes, of course. But, yep.
And we could even take another step back and assess where that value system came from. And it seems to me like there's this line that we keep on stepping back down that are things that didn't really come from
us, but came from our culture or maybe our upbringing. Right. But if you keep doing that, then what you're going to end up with is a determinist state of affairs where no one makes any choices. All they do is respond blindly to the circumstances that came before. And that's a denial of human will. Now, I think maybe the answer to this is that human beings are the kinds of creatures that have visibility of moral categories and what is appropriate and what is not. If they choose not to value the good, it does not change what the good actually is, and it doesn't even change their awareness of what the good is. I'm bad and I know I'm bad and I'm glad for it. That's their attitude. Well, they're still responsible. Even though that's their value system, they know what the good is and they choose not to do it. That's what it means to be culpable for a behavior, to be blameworthy. You know the good, but you don't choose to do it. Why don't you choose to do it? Because that's not my value system. And I got that value system from my culture or from my family or from my circumstances, whatever. Okay, but you still know the good and you refuse to do it. Therefore, you're culpable. If a person doesn't know the good, if they don't know the difference between right and wrong, then we don't usually hold them responsible, right? They have to have that awareness. But if they know the good and they don't do it, then they're going to be culpable, even if they are, in a certain sense, compelled by a value system that they didn't invent themselves, but they somehow inherited. That doesn't change the rightness or wrongness of the act. It doesn't change the moral quality of the act. Well, look, I've given you some things to chew on there. I probably should.
Yeah.
I got two more calls on board here in another 10 minutes.
Yeah, I don't want to take up anybody else.
No, you've been fine. And I think I really appreciate your call, Kino, because I think that this is a perceptive question in light of Amy's and my discussion about the nature of free will and the nature of moral responsibility and moral culpability. And I want to give you something substantive to chew on and to think about.
Yeah, and I'll have to come back and re-listen to it and think through it again.
Okay.
I'm just curious if you can recommend any, I don't know, blogs, content that covers this type of topic, because I find myself having a hard time finding things that asks and answers these kind of questions that you and Amy talked about.
I'm just taking a wild shot here. There is there's a book called The Revenge of the Conscience. I have it over my shoulder here, and I know the author. I just can't think of his name right now. The Revenge of the Conscience, and maybe when Amy posts this podcast, she'll put the title of the book in the, let's see. Oh, okay. Amy has made a recommendation here. Guillaume Bignon, that Guillaume is like a French name, like William, and his last name is Bignon. Apparently he has a piece that is titled Excusing Sinners and Blaming God. Okay, so she's recommending that. Now, Guillaume is a bit on the academic side, so just be aware of that, but it is a book that you might want to get and peruse a bit. The other one, The Revenge of the Conscience. Wow, I'm bugged. Because I can't look over at my bookcase because then I'll be off the mic to do so. But I think you can just find this on Amazon, Revenge of the Conscience, and take a look at that. And that author has written some other books that have to do with these kinds of things. And there might be maybe a characterization of that. Jay Budashevsky, thank you, Amy. That's not going to help so much, though, because it's a real complicated Polish name. Okay, Jay Budashevsky is the author. So just look up Revenge of the Conscience, and then you'll see how to actually spell his name. So I appreciate the call, Keen Allen. We'll look forward to talking to you again, okay?
Yeah, have a good one.
All right, all the best. Let's go to Samuel in Seattle, Washington. And Sam, are you going to be at Reality this weekend, perchance?
I know you're having that, and I got to say, I'm probably not going to make it. I'm sorry, but
okay,
got other things going on. But
sure.
Anyway, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. So what's on your mind?
So my question is, I have a friend of mine. He's an elderly man, and he asked me a question regarding his son and a relationship that he's in. And he asked me if it was a sin for two people to live together. And they're not having sex with each other. Now, if we were talking about maybe like an 18-year-old or 20-year-old, I would say, no, there's no way that, two people could do that. But I do know that they're older, and there's some health issues there that I know that I could see that happening. Anyways, so my question is, he asked me, is it a sin? And I guess I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Sure.
And I also—
By the way, I'm curious, Sam, or Samuel, I don't know, do you prefer one or the other?
Yeah, let's go with Samuel, but—
Okay, Samuel, I'm curious why you would think that there's a difference if it was young adults, like 18-year-olds, living together without a sexual relationship and older adults living together without a sexual relationship. What difference does the age make in your mind to the propriety of the act?
I guess the issue would be maybe like a roommate or something, like a roommate type of arrangement rather than— romantic, I guess.
Okay, well, so you're talking here not about a girlfriend, and the way Amy put your question, it includes the phrase girlfriend.
I would say it is a girlfriend.
Did you say yes to the girlfriend or no?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so then it seems to me that, okay, let me back up and put it this way. If it's merely an issue of cohabiting, like you have a roommate who's a member of the opposite sex, I don't think, all things being equal, that is a sin in itself. Because you could have a female roommate or a male roommate. And when I say roommate, I mean, they got the bedroom down the hall, and then you do the kinds of things together that roommates generally do, whatever arrangement you guys make for meals. Sometimes you eat together, sometimes they don't. I mean, I've had a lot of roommates over in my lifetime. I didn't get married till I was almost 48. So, whatever. Now, when I was a Christian, all my roommates were all males, And so it's possible, I think, for people to cohabit together and be of the opposite sex. And I don't even think that would be considered weird in our culture. However, two qualifications here. If it's a girlfriend and you're a Christian, that's a different matter. First of all, if you cohabit with somebody and they're not your girlfriend and you're a Christian and your neighbors know you're Christians and they see this girl living with you, what are they going to assume? They are going to assume probably that you are living an immoral lifestyle. Now, they might not think it's immoral, but that's what it would amount to, what they're thinking, that you're not just cohabiting, you're not just splitting the rent, but you're actually in an intimate relationship with that young lady. Okay? So that is a problem in itself, because what you're doing is you're making it look like you're doing something evil, even if you're not. And that's going to reflect badly on your Christian testimony. So if it reflects badly on your Christian testimony, I think that's bad. That's wrong.
So, So if I'm hearing you correct, and I think I agree with you, Greg. I mean, I'm you know, that's my line of thinking. How would you advise this couple if they're going to your church? They should get married. And let me tell you something. Another detail too. I know. I asked my friend. I asked him, well, they had something that they're putting as a like a blocker or an excuse for not getting married, and that is that there appears to be like some sort of I think it's like a pension that is tied to, you know, a contingent.
Oh, I see. It's a legal financial issue, and if they get married, then that cuts them off from something. Is that okay?
Now, I know I know that they're not. These are not people that are living very high life, you know, a luxury life or anything like that.
Right.
How would you advise someone like that?
Well, I don't think that the financial ramifications make any difference. If a gal is willing to pay all the expenses and a guy moves in with her and they're not married, he's saying, "Look, if I move out, then I'm going to have to pay my own rent." I don't see how that's relevant to the moral question. If you're not a Christian, do whatever you want, because non-Christians don't have to live by Christian standards. It's wrong, but they have to answer to God. If you are a Christian, you are a member of a community that follows certain rules. And therefore, even if you're not in a sexual relationship, but it's a girlfriend, oh, come on, please. Been there, done that kind of thing. You know, nobody's there but you two. She's down the hall. Right? And things like, forget about that. There is no protection there. And if we just stipulate that, okay, there is no sexual relationship that's inappropriate and never will be, even if we just stipulate, what you're doing is you're living as if you're a married couple and you're not married. And it just strikes me that there are certain behaviors or ways of living together that are only appropriate for a certain kind of relationship. And so you're kind of stealing from that relationship, even though you're not having sex, by cohabiting together. Cohabiting is a sharing of a life and sharing of a home. And in fact, according to the law, if you do that for very long with one woman, you're considered married. Even without the license, it's a common law marriage. And I frankly, I don't know if the sexual element even enters into that. Maybe, maybe not. But you could see the point. If you're living, for all intents and purposes, except for the sexual, and as a married person, then you are kind of playing at being married. And being married is really has a lot of gravity to it, all right? It isn't the kind of thing you play at. And I think that's what would be happening here. And so my counsel would be that the people who are in this relationship and in the church need to move out from each other. Oh, well, that's going to cost us. So what? That's part of being an adult. You pay for yourself. Or get married. Or I guess maybe the circumstances, if they get married, then they lose this financial. Well, when you get married, you take your finances change. Trust me, that's true for every guy and gal. Their finances change because there's all kinds of obligations you don't have, you didn't have that you have now financially. So that's not an excuse for continuing this kind of relationship.
Yeah.
It's just not right.
Okay.
So whether they listen or not, that's another matter. But go ahead. Sorry, Thamel.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, I'm hearing you, Greg, and I guess I'm having a kind of a difficulty because I know there's probably going to be a hardship there with them if they choose that. And then the other thing that's going to happen is I think they're probably going to be I'm going to see if I can get them to come to our church here. Mm-hmm. And I need to just kind of think about like we don't give people a test when they come to our church. You know,
right.
you guys married, you know, what's,
right.
You know, what kind of sins do you guys have? So in that sense, I told, you know, my friend who's their dad, I told him that they were welcome in our church.
Mm-hmm.
I did say something along the lines of as we learn more about God's word, we're always convicted as to what we should be doing.
Sure.
And that would be, That would be my
goal. I think that there's wisdom in that. I mean, Jesus first catches his fish, then he cleans them. But there's more we could say about this. I have one last call I have to get to. So, Sam, I'm going to say goodbye, okay?
Yeah, and I thank you.
Okay, you're so welcome. Thank you for the call. Let's talk with, let's see, Houston. Houston, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hello, Houston.
My name is Houston, and I'm 12, and I'm a big fan of your show.
Well, you made it. We just got a couple of minutes, but I did want to get to you before we went off the air. What's on your mind, Houston?
So we just moved, and we're visiting churches. Churches are doing communion monthly or biweekly, and a group doing it weekly, and I'm wondering if it's scriptural to do it less often. And what's your opinion on the timing of communion in a church service?
And you mean timing within the church service or how often during the month that you actually have communion?
What I mean is like how often, like monthly or weekly, like does it really matter?
Right. Well, biblically, there is no instruction that I'm aware of. It does say that we are to practice the Lord's table, you know, share communion together, and that and some churches, characteristically, churches do that on, we'll say, once a month, maybe the first Sunday of the month. Many, many churches do it that way. Many churches do it every service. Roman Catholics do it every single service. It's the central feature of the service. So they have communion every single time. Lutherans, let me think. Church of Christ types have communion every single service. So I think it's just a matter of individual choice. That it is a sacrament for the church. That means there's something spiritual and important going on. You're proclaiming the Lord's death until he returns. But it is something that is up to the individual church to decide when. It is not required one way or another. Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay, the timing isn't required one way or another is what I mean. It is required that we practice that sacrament, but not that we do it on a regular, like weekly or monthly or daily or whatever it happens to be. I'm just looking at the time. There, my music is up here, and I thank you, Houston, for the call. I'm sorry I gave you the short shrift a little bit there, but that's the end of the show. And I'm going to disappear and turn into a pumpkin, which would be appropriate for this season, wouldn't it? Anyway, Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.